From the Media Factory in the south end of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro. Today on Write the Book, you'll hear a conversation with Mohsin Hamid, whose latest novel is The Last White Man, published by Riverhead Books. This interview is about a half an hour, and after that, I will play some music for you. Mohsin Hamid is the author of four other novels, Exit West, How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia, The Reluctant Fundamentalist, and Moth Smoke, and also a book of essays, Discontent and Its Civilizations. His writing has been translated into 40 languages, featured on bestseller lists, and adapted for the cinema. Born in Lahore, he has spent about half of his life there and much of the rest in London, New York, and California. The Last White Man, his latest novel, opens with a sentence that might ring a literary bell. One morning, Anders, a white man, woke up to find he had turned a deep and undeniable brown. Offering that nod to Kafka, the book goes on to share Anders' story. His skin has turned dark, and the reflection in the mirror seems a stranger to him. At first, he shares his secret only with Una, an old friend turned new lover. Soon, reports of similar events begin to surface. Across the land, people are awakening in new incarnations, uncertain how their neighbors, friends, and family will greet them. Some see the transformations as the long-dreaded overturning of the established order that must be resisted to a bitter end. In many, like Anders' father and Una's mother, a sense of profound loss and unease wars with profound love. As the bond between Anders and Una deepens, change takes on a different shading, a chance at the kind of rebirth, an opportunity to see ourselves face to face anew. My interview with Mohsin Hamid begins with my asking my first question. I hope you enjoy our conversation. You write at the beginning in a section called Dear Reader about the gestation period for the book and how your life changed after 9/11. So I thought maybe we would start there and you could talk about the inspiration and why it took you a while to write the book.
Yeah, in a sense, so The Last White Man is a novel about a character, Anders, who wakes up one morning and he's dark. And before that, he had gone to bed light. And he and his girlfriend, Una, and their parents go through this experience. And in a sense, for me, after 9/11, a very strange thing happened. You know, I had been to these elite universities and had a well-paying job in New York, and by and large, had lived a life in the U.S. without too many restrictions, without feeling much impediment in my passing. And then afterwards, suddenly I found myself being pulled out of the line at airports and given extra screening and held for hours at immigration when I came into the country in a secondary inspection room, finding people seeming uncomfortable if I were to come onto a bus a bit unshaven with a backpack. I suddenly became this creature who was evoking a kind of suspicion or even a sense of threat in other people. And I remember wanting this to go away, wanting things to go back to the way they were, wanting to communicate, look, I'm still the same, nothing to be alarmed by here. And I felt a real sense of loss, like I'd lost something. And I wondered for some time, you know, what is it that I've lost? And later it occurred to me that I'd lost, you know, a kind of partial whiteness, that I'd had, you know, many of the benefits, although I have brown skin and a Muslim name. I had many of the benefits that came from living in a cosmopolitan city with my particular background. I could, you know, date more or less whoever I chose to and live where I wished to go and have the kind of jobs I wished to have. And then I thought, you know, was I complicit in this thing? You know, was there something that maybe I shouldn't be missing, but instead be asking myself, you know, what was I participating in? Mm-hmm. What was this thing which can be taken away? And if you have it taken away, you suddenly become this object of suspicion. And as the decades went by, that led to this novel about somebody who loses, in a sense, their whiteness. Mm-hmm.
Thank you. That's a great summary of everything you went through and also the book itself. You have one more line from the Dear Reader section that really jumped out at me. It had to do with not being nostalgic for the past. And you write, "We must imagine our futures, or rather we must permit our imaginations futures to play with." I really liked that. And I particularly was taken with it as a writer. And I thought, do you think that's easier for a writer to do, to imagine a future?
Well, I think, so much of what we think of fiction these days has to do with representation. You know, what it has been like to be me or to be people who are like me. And that's an incredibly important part of art. But there's another part of art, which is imagining being other people, mm-hmm. Imagining living other lives. You know, when we're children, we play make-believe and we pretend that we're astronauts or firemen or police officers or explorers or dinosaurs. And when we do this, we are stepping into a different kind of existence. And it's enormously attractive to children. You know, my son, even now, can sometimes be heard sort of stomping down the corridor, you know, roaring mightily. He's 10, but he occasionally still likes being Godzilla or a T-Rex. And I think that aspect of allowing ourselves to imagine our way out of ourselves is very fertile. It's another very important aspect of fiction. And one of the problems we face today is it's become so difficult to imagine, you know, desirable futures for ourselves and our societies that are inclusive, that allow people in and that we can actually get to, that we would want to inhabit. And if we can't imagine those things, we become, in a sense, pessimistic and we become nostalgic and we start saying, well, things should be like they were in the old days. We should go back to the past, which I think is a very dangerous tendency. So one of the things that I think fiction writers and artists and people just generally we need to do is to start imagining our way into more hopeful looks at where we could go.
Okay. Let's talk a little more specifically about your book and the characters. The very opening was fun to read because, of course, it reminded me of Metamorphosis. And I wondered if you ever thought of naming Anders Gregor.
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, it's one of these things where if I was writing my first novel, I might well have, you know. I think you can go a little bit heavy handed with your illusions when you're starting out. I have always been really attracted to the modernist writing of the early and middle 20th century. Writers like Kafka and Camus and Virginia Woolf and Calvino, Borges, because they would play with form. And they would play with how novels were built, and they would play with perspective and point of view and how we think. And I think that they wrote in a time which also felt, I imagine, like quite an oppressive time, where there was war and conflict and where it seemed like the future could be quite bleak. Mm-hmm. And these formal games that they played was a way of sort of slipping out of the constraints of the present moment. And so, it seems to me that a lot of those moves that writers made almost 100 years ago are quite useful for writers today, because we also live in a time of conflict where the future feels quite oppressive. And we can learn perhaps from our writerly ancestors of a century ago.
I think it did another thing for your reader, which is any reader who would recognize that reference will immediately be thinking, instead of any sort of hesitation, like, well, this could never happen, which is, of course, not how your novel should be read at all. Whether or not it could happen, you're supposed to sort of live in that universe for a while. So that was interesting. Another book that had that this had me thinking of, and I'm wondering if it's an influence for you, was Saramago's Blindness. Had you been interested in that one? I'm sure you've heard this before in your interviews.
No, actually, well, I've heard it about Saramago before with my novel Exit West, I think that Saramago certainly engages in this kind of thing where he'll take an aspect of reality and bend it, and I find that also to be a very, very fertile approach.
Yes,
it's something different from saying everything about our world is different. Instead, it's to say everything about our world is the same, but one thing or two small things change. Mm-hmm. And what would that do? And for a reader, I suppose one aspect you talked about the opening of the book is you sort of need to do it quickly. You know, you when you're getting to know the reader in the opening pages of a book, you set the terms of the relationship. And so whether it's Kafka or Saramago, it's you, in a sense, present the reader with, here's how this is going to work. And then you just keep going.
Right.
And
this is the world as you're going to know it. This is it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And in the same way, you meet somebody, they've got a slightly different accent or they've got a quirky sense of humor or whatever it is. If it pops up at you in the first encounter, you're like, oh, this is who this person is. And right. You kind of go with it. The danger, of course, is trying to do it later in a book when the reader expects one kind of book and gets something else. So I think it's better done as part of the hello, which is how I try to do it in mine.
And I don't mean to start out with two books that this reminded me of and make it sound like this is like those. It's a very unique book, and I really loved it. I loved reading this book. I wanted to ask you about a question about something that happens early on. When Anders wakes up and faces himself in the mirror, the face looking back at him was not his at all. And then in reaction, he tries to stay calm. And you have this sentence. You mind if I read a longer sentence?
Sure.
He forced his gait to slow, to become more deliberate, measured, and whether he did this to assert his control over the situation, to compel reality to return through sheer strength of mind, or because running would have frightened him more, made him forever into prey being pursued. And it goes on. And we'll talk about your style of writing in this book, too. But I wonder if you can talk about the decision to explain this moment in this kind of detail. I found that really interesting.
Well, what the book starts doing very early on is it adopts a particular approach. So in this instant, what we see is we see Anders continuously evolving his reaction to something in the course of one sentence. You know, something is happening, and then it changes, and then it changes, and then it changes. And I think so much of human life and experience is like that. It's not that we suddenly make a statement, and then that statement is true forevermore. I am this, or this is that. Often we'll make a kind of tentative statement, and then having said it, we'll say, oh, that's not quite right. I actually think something slightly different. And then the next day, we'll think something else, and we'll keep evolving our position. I think human beings are actually very fluid. One of the dangers, in fact, of our current cultural moment is that sometimes we put down, you know, words, and then we feel compelled to live or die by the words that we said just a few minutes ago because we presented them to the public. I think it's very dangerous for you know, to be bound in that way. But Anders' point of view is changing. And even in the sentences he's walking, his experience of what he's doing is changing. And so this sentence is setting up, I guess, a rhythm in the novel of changing point of view, both within Anders, but also sometimes moving in one sentence from Anders to his father to kind of an omniscient point of view, which allows the reader to begin to have, hopefully, a vantage point that's open to change, that's open to being changed, and that's open in a way to what happens in the novel.
That reminds me of something else I was going to ask you, now trying to find it. There are multiple moments where your characters are kind of forcing normalcy because it's the easiest way into what will feel comfortable. Here's an example. Her mother, okay, and we need to talk about Una and her mother, too. I may be getting ahead of myself, but this is just about a certain sense in the novel. Her mother said, maybe we should have breakfast. And somehow this felt to Una like the very best thing her mother could possibly have said. And if it did not feel like that, Una forced it to feel like that. And Una smiled and nodded and said, yes, it's on its way. It's like there are these moments where these characters decide, I'm going to make this the truth. And I loved that. I just felt like it's such a different world if the whole world is changing all at once and we don't know what to do with that. It's so honest to say, well, this may or may not be how I feel, but it's how I'm going to try to feel.
I think that that's what we do so much in our lives. You know, we are, it's as though we're always trying to find our ballast to come back to what we think is normal, even mm-hmm. in the most abnormal situations. Something will happen. And, you know, very often, for example, I remember that in Lahore when there was a period of regular bombings and blasts and sort of terrorism in the city. And people outside Lahore imagined that people in Lahore would have been, you know, obsessed with this stuff. But most people were trying to pretend that life could just go on as normal, trying not to think about these things, trying to just, you know, still go to the shops and still go to the restaurants and still see their friends and have life not be different. Similarly, you know, when a loved one gets an illness or we ourselves get our illness, there's a desperate desire for it not to be happening, for things to be okay, to be normal. And so in a sense, in the novel, what happens again and again is that the characters are trying to find their way back to a normal emotional state in very abnormal circumstances, which is what I think most of us are doing most of our lives. And allows them, instead of, I guess, foregrounding the changes, foregrounding the fact that people are changing and ceasing to be of one race, in quotes. Instead, we're focused on people just trying to be. The changes are actually something they don't want to look upon. And I think that focuses on the character, and the character, of course, gives us a way in. Mm-hmm. It lets us move away from the way that nonfiction will often discuss things, you know, from the outside. Here's what's happening to these people. Instead, in fiction, what we get to do is to say, here's what it's like on the inside. Here's what it is to be these people. Let's be them together and see how that makes us feel.
Oh, I like that. That's great. Now, so I did bring up some names that will be unknown to listeners, so let's go there. So Anders has at the beginning of the book, she's really sort of a love interest, I would say, more than a girlfriend, Una. And I liked her character, and I loved her situation. She's living with a mother whose life has been affected by losing her husband and losing her son, Una's brother. And Una's mother is just a fascinating character to me and reminds me of people I know from another generation. So that was very interesting to me. Can you talk a little bit about developing Anders and Una, also developing their relationship as time goes by, which is a wonderful thread in the book? It's wonderful to watch the deepening of this relationship, which I didn't have a great sense would have deepened otherwise if it hadn't been for the events of the book.
I think you're probably right. You know, it's interesting because Anders and Una start seeing each other more clearly as they change. It's as though the change allows them to understand what hasn't changed, that they're seeing each other as strangers, but within the stranger, they're seeing something they recognize and something, in fact, that they like and are attracted to, that they have shed a particular external appearance and found something deeper, which they probably wouldn't have found otherwise. As you say, they were brought together by a kind of loss. Their relationship was sort of fling. But as they navigate this new loss, the loss of a kind of identity, they begin to build something together. And in that sense, the novel is a novel very much that's a eulogy, that's a mourning for something by people who feel that they're experiencing a loss, but also a birth story, the birth of something new. And that those two stories are eliding in Anders and Una, who are both losing and gaining something as the novel continues.
Mm-hmm. You tackle a lot of issues in this book, not just race. You talk about how Anders' mother died from bad water, basically. You talk about environmental factors, guns, job security, education, addiction. Did these things just come up as you worked on a book about a world that is otherwise just like our world, or did you sort of have some things you wanted to tackle and you found ways to work them in?
Probably both. You know, as you know, the process by which this stuff happens is a little bit mysterious.
Yeah.
So it's not exactly clear what's going on a lot of the time. But one thing that I very often do try to do is to engage in a kind of compression, to write, you know, very small things that contain lots within them. That can be unpacked, because it's as though the reader gives a novel this enormous opportunity of decompression. You know, you present the reader with a sentence or a paragraph or a chapter, and the reader can do enormous things with that. So I suppose in my novels, what I try to do is to pass through things briefly and to touch upon things, and then to leave lots and lots of space for the reader to take those things and go where they wish. So if the reader wants to pause at a particular sentence or at the end of a chapter or put it aside for a bit and just let things sit, they can. Or they can keep moving forward, and that can keep echoing. And when they're done reading, they can come back to that. So the book, as you say, it touches upon a great many things, but it touches upon them in a way briefly, but hopefully invitingly. Mm-hmm. So the reader is free to do with them what the reader chooses to do.
Yes. Okay, great. I don't want to forget to ask you about your writing style in this book. And I'm sorry to say, I don't remember very well your writing style in the previous books I
read. Right.
But this one has this wonderful, it worked so well with this story. So here's one example. You're talking about Una and Anders. So it was that they came to have that night's sex, which was such an interesting way to word that sentence. The book is full of language that reminds me of a fable. I'm not the first to say that, I know, from having read other comments about the book. It's so perfect for the subject matter. So first of all, your sentences are sort of long and winding, and they lead us almost down a story each sentence, you know, taking us along through a series of whatever the events of the moment are. But also the fable voice is just such a perfect, you know, it's just such a perfect way of showing us the absurdity of our belief system. It's like the emperor who has no clothes, you know. It's this wonderful way of showing us that we are making mistakes in how we, whom we respect, what we value, how we set our belief systems. So is that just your style, or was that more so in this book?
Well, you know, each book has a way of being told. Each story has a way of being told. It has a certain formal nature. You know, what form is the best way for this story to come into existence? And part of that form is, you know, what kind of story is it? Well, this is a story where people change in their appearance. And we begin with Anders. But it's also at the level of sentences and how those sentences work and how they're built. And, you know, partly, I suppose, what the novel begins with is this notion that we already live in a fable. Before you even open the book, there's a fable of existence that we're all inhabiting. Like, we've made up this stuff called race. You know, it's not like a waterfall or a planet. It doesn't actually exist. We've just chosen to imagine it into existence. And then now that we've imagined it into existence, to do all sorts of stuff with it, much of which is quite terrible. So what the novel does, in a way, is it doesn't invite us into this other fable. It hopes to try to destabilize the fable we're already inhabiting. And so it takes a form that does that. And part of the way it does that is in these sentences, one is it's always requalifying a position. Each clause is sort of building on the previous one, and we're kind of flowing. It's a very fluid way of expressing ideas. And the other one is that we're in different characters' minds, you know, Anders's mind, his father's mind, Una's mind in one sentence. These are lessons, I guess, which I got when I was a young man about 30 years ago. I had the enormous cosmic good fortune of taking a class with Toni Morrison.
And oh, wow.
She told her students back then, she said, you know, keep your reader a half heartbeat ahead of the action. They shouldn't know what's coming next, but when it happens, it should feel inevitable.
Oh, that's great.
And so in that sense, you know, I suppose one of the tasks of the writer and my task in this book was to build a form that allowed the novel to do certain things and gave permission for it to do certain things. But when those things happen, to have the reader accept them. You know, how do you build a novel where the reader will accept what's happening without knowing what's going to happen? And in that sense, whether it's the fable form or the way the sentences work, all these things are doing that work of preparing the reader for a particular kind of experience.
Great. Okay, so as people see each other change, and it's not just Anders who's changing, society, you know, little by little, a lot of people are changing color. And interesting things happen, some violence, some, you know, positive reactions as the story unfolds. I did wonder, as you were writing, did you ever worry about how any of this might be received?
Yeah, you know, I did worry about it. It was very strange. I was about a third of the way in, and I turned to my wife, who's my first reader of my books, and said, you know, is this book okay? I mean, what do you think of this? Is this, you know, am I completely insane? You know, what is this? And she said, you know, she read it, and normally she's very good about telling me if she likes something or doesn't like something. And she, you know, she's very courageous, because telling a writer that you don't like what they're writing is a brave thing to do, which she does often. And she also said, wow, this is a very weird book. I like it, but I don't know what to say about it. You know, maybe you should show your editor. You know, you do have this person who you've been working with since your first book, the last quarter century. And this is what editors are actually for. Send it to your editor and see what she says. So I sent it to my editor. I said, look, I don't often do this. It's been maybe decades since I have, but I'm about a third of the way into a manuscript. And I'm wondering, am I completely insane? Or, you know, is this an actual novel that might work? And she read it and came back and said, you know, what's the problem? Keep going. And I did have, I think, a sense of nervousness about this terrain. But I thought that probably is something very worthwhile. If you're feeling nervous, it maybe is a good thing. And so, you know, let me try to approach this as respectfully as I can. You know, let me try to give, you know, Anders and Anders's father and Una and her mother, in a sense, a degree of compassion for their sense of loss, which is separate from whether I think what they are losing is something that is good to have in the first place. Mm-hmm. And that approach, I guess, of having a kind of compassion for this, brings you closer to your characters. It brings you more able to imagine their experience. And that's what I've tried to do. I am, I guess, nervous about putting this book into the world, but I also am really glad and, I suppose, happy in a way to put into the world. I hope it doesn't provoke a negative reaction, but I think it was built in a way that wasn't intended to be provocative so much as invitational.
Great. And you just mentioned Anders' father and Una's mother, and I did want to talk a little bit more about those characters. And I think this may be an example of something you were just talking about. You know, they're so real, and their pain is very real. And Anders' father, there's this incredible passage when he first sees his son, and his reaction is one of kind of sadness, but it's beautiful because he's sad because Anders was a boy in his mother's mold, and his mother's gone. She has passed away, and Anders no longer looks like her. And his reaction is kind of twofold. He sees that his wife has vanished now. He's not going to see her anymore when he looks at his son. But he's also sad that his son is going to suffer. And you just, it's this most beautiful sentence. He's holding on to the fabric of his son's sleeve, and he's weeping. It was just absolutely beautiful, and it really drew me in and gave me such empathy for this moment in his life. And I think that's the kind of moment that makes it very real to all of us, you know, to the extent that there is absurdity in this book. That is not one of those moments.
Yeah, well, I think, you know, for me, it's very important, in a sense, to allow characters to be the heroes of their own stories. You know, whether we agree with them or don't agree with them, whether their worldview is something that we feel sympathy for or don't feel sympathy for, I think the basic heroic nature or attempted heroic nature of a human life that each of us would like to be, even if we often fail to be, the hero of the life that we're living, is something I try to give all of these characters to in a sense. Anders's father is somebody who's grappling with a very difficult situation, not just, you know, the nearing end of his own life and his illness, but also his son's predicament. And he's trying to do it as best he can. And I think that that dignity, I suppose, is very important. It's that, you know, to acknowledge that there is this profound dignity in this human being, even if he's grappling with something that to him is deeply, deeply upsetting.
Was it hard for you to access the perspectives of characters whose belief systems are very different from yours? And I'm thinking mostly of Una's mother or some of the more sort of racist characters in the book.
It wasn't hard in a sense, to access these places. And I think one of the things in writing this book that I felt was, who among us doesn't have these impulses? You know, who among us doesn't have sometimes the impulse to look down on other people, or to imagine that their way is better, or to feel frightened that their children will be different from them? So in a sense, these characters, the way they express those things might be different from how I express these things, but their humanity isn't fundamentally different from my own humanity. And that, I think, for me as a writer was an enormously healing thing, I think, to write these people as human.
Wonderful. I've been speaking with Mohsin Hamid about his new novel, The Last White Man, published by Riverhead. I want to thank you so much for speaking with me today.
Thank you very much.
From the Media Factory in the South End of Burlington, Vermont, this is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP Burlington, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. This is Write the Book, the show for writers and curious readers. That was an interview with Mohsin Hamid about his new book, The Last White Man, published by Riverhead. You can find more of his work at mohsinhamid.com. You can also find my earlier interview with Mohsin on the podcast site. We discussed his novel, How to Get Filthy Rich in Rising Asia, also published by Riverhead. That was several years ago, but another great conversation. This week's Write the Book prompt is to write about a drastic change in a character's life, even something unlikely or impossible, that changes their world in some way, bringing both difficulty and ultimately maybe relief. Good luck with your work in the coming week, and tune in next week for another prompt or suggestion. I would love your feedback about the show. Let me know if you'd like me to interview certain authors or if you have events to announce. If you like the show, please rate it where you get your podcasts, like it on Facebook, and talk about it. Be sure to tell your friends about Write the Book and about the podcast site, writethebook.podbean.com. We are also on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and lots of other podcast sites. You can visit Write the Book on Twitter and on Facebook for updates, and you can also access the podcast at my own website, shelaughswithoutus.com. I'm Shayla Connor Shapiro, and you've been listening to Write the Book. This is 99.3 FM, WBTV LP, Burlington, Vermont, streaming online at 99.3wbtv.org. I hope that you are doing well, having a great summer. Stay well and have a great week.